Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 108, with guests Alexis Johnson, who's the writer and creator of Real Cathedrals and also a contributor here at Real World Theology, along with Blaine Grimes, host of the Real World Rewind podcast. So listen up, because we've got a really great show for you. On this episode, we talk Midnight Special and Surprised by Hope.
So I'm glad I have you guys on here, but I'm actually kind of curious. We're talking about a movie, or we're going to be talking about a movie that came out comparatively a long time ago relative to almost every other movie we do. And we do this usually once or twice a year. This usually happens around award season where we're trying to catch up, like in February and March, from all the, you know, it came out on December 25th, but it really didn't come out till like January 17th. So we kind of end up in that place there. And we also, usually in the September, pre-October, though movies are getting better because award season is always stretching further and further out of, you know, November into October and now out of October, maybe into September, we'll see. Usually September slower, the end of August usually isn't that great. Lots of like last minute summer blockbuster type movies that end up being very Ben-Hur-ish. I'm just going to go on a limb. When we're recording this, Ben-Hur hasn't come out, but I know we had a very long conversation about what we think of Rotten Tomatoes, but Rotten Tomatoes is not giving it very good scores. The previews look awful, and why do we need Ben-Hur? But that's what we're kind of getting at the end of August, usually during the summer. So September usually is a time where we can go back and look at movies that came out in the first half of the year. Maybe they were smaller. Maybe they were independent released. Not many of us, sadly, live in large market cities, so we're not getting limited releases very often. So Midnight Special kind of falls in that category of a movie that was talked about a lot, but it was talked about almost in spurts. So usually what'll happen, especially on our Facebook discussion group or other places around social media, or conversations I have in real life, a movie comes out, like on Friday, and I'm guessing this probably happens to you guys too. Movie comes out on Friday, so Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and throughout the week, next week, people are talking to you about that movie, right? Like, that's when most of the conversations happen. If there's controversy, that's when the controversy's happening. But with movies like this, I'll see someone go, has anyone seen Midnight Special yet? It was crazy. And they'll want to talk about it, but like almost no one can respond. And then it'll be like 2 weeks later and someone else will see it and they'll post the same thing. Like, Midnight Special was crazy. And then like two or three people will respond. And then, you know, it'll go and go until you're now, what, 6 months out or something. And, or like 5-6 months out. And now almost anyone who wants to see it has been able to see it via digital release or wider release and things like that. And so now when we have that conversation, people can be like, oh, but we've all seen that movie. We're finally having this discussion and everyone can more or less be a part of it. So that is the wacky, wacky world of independent films released throughout the year for us, Blaine and Alexis and myself, who don't live in major cities. Saying that, it's kind of surprising because I feel like the maker of this film, Jeff Nichols, is someone who's kind of gaining in popularity. I know he's gaining popularity, especially after this film, and knowing that his next movie, Loving, looks like it's going to be have a slightly bigger release. But
yeah, I'm really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, right. So. Mm-hmm. What I want to ask you guys to kind of start this episode out is, it's not like Jeff Nichols is working with people we've never heard of. I mean, it's not the first time he's worked with Michael Shannon or Joel Edgerton. So, you know, he's got pretty decent stars in his movies, and yet we're still getting independent releases. So when people start talking these movies up, or people say, oh, you've got to go see the latest Jeff Nichols movie, it's kind of funny to me. And I didn't look up, and even if I did, I wouldn't call them out. But someone recently on our discussion group said, and I'm paraphrasing, can someone just explain Jeff Nichols to me? So I'm going to take that question as a great opening question and say, Alexis, for people who haven't seen Jeff Nichols films, or maybe people who have only seen one and they don't really get what he does in a number of his films. I mean, cause he's made, Take Shelter and Mud. And like I said, he's making Loving, which is coming out later this year. Can you explain Jeff Nichols to the listeners?
Can I explain him? Well, I was trying to see if I could pull up what I said to said person in question.
Hypothetically,
if I had said anything. Well, I think, and then your wife, actually, Laura, had said something. She put it well, too, with saying his films are very spiritual. They have like a spiritual theme to them. I thought that was, see, I can't even remember what she said. This is why podcasting at the end of the workday. Just kidding. let me see. I'm just going to see if I can find it. But yeah, for me, he's kind of like an Americana with a slight twinge of science fiction, because his films seem to take place in very American settings.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that in the best sense. Like, I feel like there's definitely some unsettling things in his movies, but I feel like it's more showing America on a better angle, or yeah.
Well,
the
it's
better
like
side of America.
Day-to-day America, maybe?
Yeah, there you go. That's a better way of putting it. So it's kind of like it has that feel to it. And then, here I found the thing. Yeah, but also he's just really has like the slight science fiction twinge, which really makes it interesting. That was more in, I mean, Mud didn't really have that. Mud was strictly like an American indie film, but Take Shelter and this film had a science fiction element to it, a sort of like you have to stretch your imagination sort of thing. And I really love that because it's subtle and it's kind of popping up actually more and more in indie films. I worked at an indie location theater, which is still here, the Harkins Camel View, and they get a lot of limited release films. That was all they showed at the time when I worked there. And they had like Another Earth and a lot of other films that were really very indie, but had a science fiction element or a sort of fantasy element that sort of stretched your imagination. It's more about, his films are more about the characters' inner journey than the premise. I mean, the premise is cool. There's always like a twisty, like, ooh, how's this going to end? Or where is this leading us? Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's more about the character journey, like how the character looks on the other side of the tunnel.
And you're seeing that going through almost all his films.
Yes, yes.
Not that we're talking about like a catalog of 20 films. I mean, we're still talking about like three or four films at this point.
Yeah, I think he's had four. Yeah, or this will be his fourth one coming up. Mm. So, yeah, really good though. I mean, just yeah, there's a very compelling spiritual aspect to the films. There's usually like something that stretches your belief in either a person or an idea. So that's a bad explanation as far as it's kind of all over the place, but I would describe him that way as just being a very subtle American indie filmmaker that makes films that sort of push you to believe in something greater and are also about the character journey.
Okay. Well then let me ask you a question that will hopefully give you a chance to kind of whittle down that answer or maybe pinpoint that answer a little better. And I would ask, do you connect with Jeff Nichols' films or what he's trying to do? And what is it that thematically or technically in his films do you typically come away with liking the most?
Oh, I really connect with his films. I loved I saw Take Shelter when I worked at that theater, and I was just totally, you know, I fell in love with that movie. I like that you can relate to the character struggle. There's usually some kind of psychological or spiritual struggle that the character's going through, and Take Shelter, it's kind of a paranoia, fear, anxiety sort of thing. And I could kind of relate to that part. But just seeing that faith and strength and spirituality is kind of what carried the character through that. I find that really compelling. So
I think that's really good. So Blaine, I don't necessarily need you to just give like a thumbs up or feel like you have to come up with a different answer than Alexis, but I guess I would ask you that original question too. Can you explain Jeff Nichols' films to someone who hasn't seen them?
Yeah, I don't know that I can. And I think that's one of the things that makes him an interesting filmmaker, to say the least, if he's not great.
No,
I'm a Jeff Nichols fan. But I will say that, to kind of bridge off of a couple of things that Alexis said, I think Jeff Nichols, he is an auteur who likes to make nods to other genres and other styles, mm-hmm. be it literary or filmic, what have you. And I think a couple of styles or genres that he alludes to in a lot of his films, one is Southern Gothic. So I think he nods to Southern Gothic literature in many of his works. So Southern Gothic literature, we immediately think of somebody like Faulkner or my favorite, Flannery O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
And in Southern Gothic literature, location is very, very important. And as you can tell, you know, by the title of the genre, it's set in the South. And so a lot of Nichols' films are set in Texas or Louisiana. They've got these sort of Southern settings, although Texas isn't really technically the South. But they've got these sort of Southern settings, and they also have a little bit of a twinge of Gothic in the sense that they have not straight up grotesque characters like O'Connor had. They have characters who are maybe outcasts or, you know, they're on the edges of society, and maybe some of these characters are a little bit odd. Even if they're not these immensely grotesque characters like O'Connor created.
Yeah.
So there's this nod to Southern Gothic. And then he sort of makes some nods to minimalism in the sense that he's not always following this sort of direct cause and effect style of filmmaking that you see in major Hollywood films. And so there might be little beats left out. I'm sure we'll talk about at some point in here the point where the cult just kind of disappears in the movie,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people kind of raise the question of, well, what's up with that? Did he just forget? What, like, is it terrible filmmaking? I don't think so. I think he's doing something very, very intentional there. I think he's making the kind of film that he wants to make, and he's wanting the viewer to take a more active role, which is a characteristic of minimalist literature, at least. I'm not saying he is a minimalist filmmaker. He's mm-hmm. he's certainly not, but he sort of makes nods. He sort of tips the hat to those things. And so then for me, the reason Nichols resonates with me is because of the location. I've been to a lot of the places he's filmed at. Like, I've been there, I've lived close to those places. I'm from Texas. So just being in that location, understanding some of that culture, it means a lot to me. Even the opening of Midnight Special, what I think it's, there's the TV playing and it's talking about Fort Worth. It's like the news program in Fort Worth. So like just this location sort of resonates with me. It makes me feel at home. And then also, similar to what Alexis said, his films have very, very strong theme of family. In fact, I think it might've been Reed Lackey on one of our Facebook groups mentioned how Jeff Nichols is almost a filmmaker who's making films about family or relationships. Mm. Sorry, Reed, if I butchered that. But so that connects with me, those kinds of themes that he deals with. And that's probably the closest I can come to articulating Jeff Nichols.
Well, it's interesting because I had someone ask me today, oh, you know, what are you doing this evening? I was like, oh, I got a podcast to record. What are you recording on? Oh, Midnight Special. And they just kind of gave me a quizzical look, you know, because obviously, as I talked about at the top of the show, it's been a while since this movie came out. And not only has it been a while since this movie came out, but it wasn't huge. And of the people that knew about it, it's still hard to explain, just like you guys both just pointed out. So I'm sitting there trying to explain it. I'm like, well, there's this guy, Roy, and he is kidnapping his son from like a Christian-y cult-esque type people, because it's implied that he has some kind of possible, maybe we find out, supernatural powers, but we don't know what they are, what they do, and why. And so they're chasing them, and the FBI, in the form of Adam Driver's character, Paul, is chasing him, and he's got a buddy with him, Lucas, who's played by Joel Edgerton, and they're just kind of going somewhere. And I'm sitting there explaining, like, more or less just like this to this person. And I said, boy, this movie does not sound that interesting. It kind of sounds like I don't know what I saw. The filmmaker didn't know what he was making. But at the same time, you know, I like what you're pointing out, Blaine, that you're not saying that Nichols is a minimalist, but a minimalist tendency is to let the audience kind of figure out a lot of stuff for themselves. Yeah. Or almost be involved in the storytelling, like filling in the gaps or kind of examining something inside themselves, which is what, you know, Alexis, what you pointed out. And it's interesting that you use the word minimalist, or we talk about smaller films, because there's a number of reviews that I'll probably put in the show notes that say that Midnight Special specifically, along with probably Take Shelter to a certain degree, has this feel of almost like a classic Steven Spielberg, like E.T., Close Encounters of the Third Kind, like something supernatural in the everyday world. But that almost seems like it's contradicting what you're describing, Blaine. So would you say that that's a fair comparison on some level, or is that a stretch?
I'll say two things to that. The first is, I can see where people are getting that, and I think you said it really well. They're seeing supernatural things happen in the ordinary world. And of course this is dealing with a little kid, which Spielberg did in his films a lot. He had kid protagonists. But for me, Nichols is much more somber and, less,
hopeful.
What's hopeful? Yeah. He's much less hopeful than Spielberg. I don't even want to say that he's much less hopeful. I find Nichols' film hopeful, but they're hopeful in, I would say, and this is coming from a huge Spielberg fan, they're hopeful in a more authentic way than most of Spielberg's films. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel forced or cheap when Nichols does it, where sometimes, honestly, as much as I love Spielberg's films, and you guys know that I do, sometimes it feels cheap or forced. That doesn't mean we can't love them or anything like that, but Nichols is also is more of a realist filmmaker in that sense. So I guess I don't automatically think, oh, Spielberg, when I hear Nichols mentioned, I don't necessarily make that connection. But to kind of jump back to what you were saying, with people not really understanding him, I did get to see Midnight Special on its release, on its opening weekend, because of Alamo Drafthouse, God bless them forever. they opened it up, and so the theater was packed to go see it because they were advertising it pretty hard in our town. And I always listen to people and what they have to say when a movie's over, because it's fun for me. And most of the people in the audience after it's rolled in Midnight Special were very upset, audibly upset, talking to whoever they were with. About how they didn't like the ending. They didn't like how Nichols was not sort of handing them things. And I mean, of course, marketing sort of trumps up the supernatural aspects of the film and makes it seem like it's going to be more of a more sort of an intense Spielberg type movie than it is.
Yeah.
So I can see why people would come into it with those expectations. But yeah, I think Nichols is one of those filmmakers who, like most auteurs are, is pretty divisive, and people are going to love him and they're going to hate him.
So Alexis, do you kind of see where Blaine's going with that, or do you agree with Blaine about that Nichols being more of a grounded hope, whereas Spielberg would come across as not, again, we don't want to belittle Spielberg, but an inauthentic hope?
No, I do agree with that. I think there's definitely, Jeff Nichols has the realism going for him in that way. So there's an imaginative aspect, but there's also a very relative presentation there. So yeah, I would agree with Blaine on that. I did think of something as far as when he what he just said about people's reactions mm-hmm. and wanting to be handed things. It's kind of odd to me because I'm the total opposite right now. I don't want to be force-fed everything. I want that. That's why I love him so much too, is I can explore and I can theorize while I'm watching. And I know a lot of people do like to do that, you know, with shows and all that kind of stuff. And with Stranger Things being out, Stranger Things and Midnight Special have a lot in common. You know, they're not exactly the same or have the same tone per se, but just the children in small towns with, you know, supernatural things happening around them. It's kind of interesting how that's been popping up. So I don't know if that's going to be a continuing trend or not, but it's both from this year. So it's just kind of interesting to me, but I don't really personally want to have it all laid out for me. I enjoy the hunt. I enjoy the, you know, the idea of searching for and theorizing everything. I don't know.
That's just So I was going to say, go ahead, Blaine.
I was just going to say, isn't it nice too, that because we're Christians, we can say that Nichols is sort of a realist filmmaker in a sense, because typically we think of realism or naturalism and we think that it's about the world as it is. In other words, nothing supernatural. Because we're Christians and we believe in the eternal, like we can say, like Nichols is in a sense the truest, is a realist in the truest sense, because he believes in or his films. I don't want to say he believes, but his films sort of deal with the eternal and the metaphysical existing.
As if it were not really that supernatural, as if it were a totally normal thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm gonna steal this reference to N.T. Wright from Elijah Davison's review, where he points out that N.T. Wright says, in his book, Surprised by Hope, that God's space and ours interlock and intersect in a whole variety of ways, even while they retain, for the moment at least, their separate and distinct identities and roles. One day, they will be joined in a quite new way, open and visible to one another, married together forever. And I steal that, and I give full credit for Elijah for referencing it, because as I was talking to my wife before the show, she said the thing that's most interesting about Midnight Special is that it's about acknowledging that there's a different existence that's intertwined with our existence. There's mm-hmm. there's a reality that we can't see, and it's not presented in like this silly way, or like people have to be dumb to believe in it. Like the only people who don't believe in it in the movie are the people who are the dumb ones. Like it's actually, I mean, like the dumb ones. God, I'm so feel like I'm being a child. you know, like the people that we're not rooting for. We're actually rooting for a world like that. Blaine, is that something that is, or something that you're seeing more often in film today, or is it still kind of a revelation that Nichols is putting on screen for us?
I think Nichols is doing it in such a unique way that makes it stand out. I don't really know. I'm trying to think off the top of my head whether we're seeing this more and more. I mean, we're certainly seeing, like Alexis all pointed out, your fascination with the supernatural being connected and intertwined with our world, like in Stranger Things. But Nichols, he puts such an authentic and earnest spin on presenting a world where the spiritual is entwined with ours. Or I think the way Alton puts it, he said there's a world built on top of ours. Mm. And there's just such an interesting way to look at it. So really funny, because I actually have in my hand a quote from Surprised by Hope. And I am still going to read it, because you can't get enough N.T. Wright on the resurrection. You really can't. So we can have conversations in other places, and people have, rightfully so, about N.T. Wright and his views on justification. Some people have questioned plenty of other things about him. That's not the purpose of this podcast. But I will say, as valid as some of those concerns may be, I don't know that I've read anyone, I haven't read anyone writing today who is as thoughtful and helpful and solid on the resurrection and on heaven as N.T. Wright. N.T. Wright is absolutely fantastic, and I can't recommend Surprised by Hope enough. And he says something in Surprised by Hope. He says, heaven in the Bible is not a future destiny, but the other hidden dimension of our ordinary life, God's dimension, if you like. God made heaven and earth, and at the last he will remake both and join them together forever. And when we come to the picture of an actual end in Revelation 21 and 22, we find not ransomed souls making their way to a disembodied heaven, but rather the New Jerusalem coming down from heaven to earth, uniting the two in a lasting embrace. And I think Nichols is getting at the heart of that, too, in his own unique way.
So how does that work, though? Like, where does Nichols stop? Because we've already talked about how he leaves a lot for us to interpret, right? So is he taking us to the edge? And because we're Christians, we're going, oh, finally someone sees that there's a world on top of ours. Or is he just going like, I thought it'd be really neat to point out that sometimes children know more than adults and you're reading too much into it. Like, where is it connecting for you, Alexis? Like, is it getting you thinking about it? Or do you think there's a little more purpose behind what he's doing?
I think there's definitely purpose. I mean, I haven't read anything. I read a few things about Midnight Special, but I didn't really see anything that he had said about his actual views or why he chose to do things the way he did. But what I thought was interesting, I watched it last night, the second time. And whenever Alton's describing the world, like Blaine said, that it's built on top of ours, he also describes that these beings have been watching over us for a long time. And then, you know, not to spoiler alert, I guess if you are listening to this, you should have seen it by now. But yeah, at the end, they're revealed as like beings of light. Mm-hmm. So for me, I was like, this seems almost like angels, not really, not that he was exactly like, oh, this is what my intention was, but that's the sort of feel I got from it, was just very angelic. The whole like idea of watching over you, guarding you, or, you know, that kind of thing. There's like an angelic mythology to what he was saying there. So that does present a view of heaven. So I'm not sure what his viewpoint is per se, but I think he is exploring those ideas, whether he believes it or not, or whether he knows it or not. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he's going there, I guess.
So,
yeah, I would agree with that too. And I know I've read a couple of interviews that Nichols has done, and I know he was raised Methodist, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I think he sort of describes himself as lapsed, or at least he's skeptical of organized religion. Mm-hmm. But he also talks about, and he said in multiple interviews, that he doesn't like to interpret his films for people. And so I think what you were asking, Mikey, I would agree with what Alexis said. I think it does allow for multiple meanings, multiple interpretations intentionally. So to us as Christians, we probably look at what goes on at the end with the world on top of ours and the people watching us, and we think angels, or we think heaven, or we think eternal state, because we're Christians. But I don't know, because I haven't read many reviews of Midnight Special. I would imagine people who aren't coming from that way of understanding the world, that disposition, that they would see and interpret the ending and interpret the whole metaphysical thing in a much different way.
Mm-hmm. So a more personal question, Alexis, what does the idea of there being a world represented like we're seeing in Midnight Special change how you think about heaven in any way? Or does it excite you for what you already believe?
I would say it excites me for what I already believe. It doesn't change my beliefs, but I think that's what's so masterful about it, and why I want to, you know, why I always, since I was a kid, I've been wanting to get into the film and television industry is because I wanted to tell stories that did that too. Not necessarily that they're going to spill out for everyone, you know, who God is, what mm-hmm. heaven is, all that kind of stuff. But I do get excited by seeing that somebody is thinking that way and that it is going to plant seeds to make people question what they believe. People who may be more geared towards people who might not believe in much of anything. So that excites me, that prospect that I wonder if someone who's watching this, who maybe like Jeff Nichols himself, who's lapsed or questioning, would kind of make them want to dig deeper and find real answers from something that wasn't real. That's like, to me, the whole power of film and television and storytelling and parables is to draw you somehow to the truth or not to the truth, depending on the intention, I guess, of the person making it. But yeah, I just think it seemed really open. Like maybe Jeff Nichols wants to believe himself, but he doesn't have an answer. So he left it kind of vague or kind of open to interpretation.
So when I see things like the ending of Midnight Special or the ending of Take Shelter, for example, when you have a character go on a journey and it almost seems like they discover a truth by confirming their faith in something or their belief in something, especially that other people can't see or that other people don't understand. It strikes me almost as if Nichols is making film versions of what C.S. Lewis did for so many people so many years ago. He's basically taking something that we've assumed we understood and he's transforming it through a parable or, you know, in this case, a story or a film. And to be clear, I don't think Nichols is like at the mastercraft level yet that C.S. Lewis was and just his deep thoughtfulness about his stories and parables. But when I see the kind of the reveal at the end of Midnight Special, I have this feeling very similar to the first time I read The Great Divorce. And I'm sitting there, you know, I can't stop flipping through the pages of The Great Divorce because it's giving me not this new specific example of definitely how heaven and hell work, but a parable that kind of explains how heaven and hell work on a personal level. And it's forever changed how I see the natural world and the spiritual world. And so by watching something like Midnight Special, it's not necessarily changing because it's not a thought that I hadn't had before, but I'm interested. I almost wish I could get more people who don't believe in like a Christian theology or a Christian worldview to ask them what they think about this concept, that there's another realm that sits on top of ours. That's like Blaine, like you pointed out, the character Alton says that is built on top of ours. Just that interest, that conversation that can happen from it. But something I wanted to move to now that I've kind of done my little rant is that I noticed almost every character in this film is on their own personal journey outside of the journey that we take, as a group of characters or as a story. Everyone is going through their own ups and downs. Everyone is trying to learn something or figure something out, or honestly can almost be a mini parable inside this unintentional maybe parable, since we don't really know exactly what, you know, Nichols is doing and he doesn't want to tell us. But is there any particular character journey that really connected with you, Blaine, in this film?
Yeah, to give me time to think about that a little bit more. I also need to ask you a question about something you said.
Sure.
Because I'm curious if we saw the same thing, because I've talked with other friends who have not seen it and swore I'm crazy. When you said I saw the reveal at the end, what were you talking about?
Well, when we finally see that there is this other world. Yeah, there's this other existence sitting on top of our existence.
Okay.
Almost like hidden in plain sight.
Okay. So
wait, what did you think?
Anybody, I don't want to sidetrack us. Maybe this is a question for later and we can table it, but I do want to ask, did anybody else see Michael Shannon's eyes glow like Alton's or start to glow? And okay, good.
Yeah. That was like one of the twists I thought, but
yeah. I had some friends who were like, no way. So,
I did not notice that.
It's at the very, very, very end. I mean, it's very quick.
It's when he's looking out at the prison at the sunrise. You can it flashes like Alton's really quick.
Well, that may be a pretty interesting ending to Alton's journey. If anyone's interested in talking about that, Blaine.
Well, okay, so I can't answer your question. I didn't mean to completely derail us. But I do think I resonate a lot with, and of course I'm blanking on Michael Shannon's character,
Roy.
I think Roy resonates with me quite a bit because of this close connection. Like we talked about how Nichols deals with family and I think his relationship with Alton and his journey from, you know, he loves Alton to this extent that he's willing to let him go.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think it's really interesting that through Roy's relationship with Alton, Nichols is showing us how relationships can really mess up your perfect little life you had planned.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this idea, like if you think about most romantic comedies or something like that, the notion is, well, as soon as you get in a relationship, your life is going to be fixed then, right? Your life is a wreck before you don't have someone in your life. Well, so Nichols is kind of flipping that and saying, no, actually, when you have someone in your life, it can really screw your life up. And I mean that in a real sense. And also, it can screw your life up while simultaneously making it better, right? Relationships are messy. They're tricky. Or if you even think about someone like Mikey, you have a kid now. Your life has gotten harder because you have a kid.
Joyful.
Yeah, but harder and more joyful at the same time, right? It's this weird combination. But so this idea here that relationships, and specifically when you love someone, it takes you outside of yourself, right? Is the ultimate form of getting outside of yourself. And so it means a lot to me seeing Roy go through all of this, reconnect, you know, like drag his friend into this, reconnect with his ex. And then ultimately there's that moment that's just, it's the point I tear up in the movie when he just gives that quick Alton, and he just kind of gives him a nod before he lets him go off to his other world. So Roy, I think really, really resonates with me in that sense because of what Nichols is trying to do through him. That wasn't very well articulated, but anyways, Roy.
No, that's good. I think Roy's journey, is one that would be, I think it's one of the ones that I think changes the most depending on what your state of life is. If you are a father, like his character almost takes on this completely different view. If you're a skeptic, his journey takes on a different point of view. If you're a son, his role as a father takes on, you know, like depending on, I think his is the most diverse because all the things that go on with him give you a different perspective on what he's doing and why, and can connect with you.
Yeah. Although I will say, now that I've said all of that, I keep thinking about Paul Sevier, Adam Driver's character.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in some sense, I'm more like him. Maybe all Christians are more like him in some sense. But I think especially because I tend to be like more geared toward nerdy, like maybe academic things, analyzing things. I can kind of see myself in Paul in the sense of, like, we've got all these patterns up here and I'm going to figure it out. But you get to this point where you see something you can't explain. And of course that's what happens in the gospel, right? I mean, like we're not going to analyze our way into the kingdom of God, right? We need, as one of the Puritans said, a divine and a supernatural light to, to give us new hearts, mm-hmm. right? New loves. It's not just about what we think and having all of the right answers. It's about where our heart is geared. And so you see Paul go from this person who's all about thinking things through and planning things out to this person who seems like he's having his affections changed.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say, if I had my choice, I think the journey of a lot of these characters could be all related to a particular type of faith journey. And again, intentional or unintentional, but the one that, taking that into account, that I would relate to the most is Paul's or Adam Driver's character, because I feel like I do the same thing a lot too. I feel like I spend a lot of time getting head knowledge, and I can explain biblical concepts. I can explain theology to people. I can explain why this is right or why this is wrong, or why this makes sense or doesn't. And I figured it out, you know, just like Paul's character, he nerds it up and just figures everything out. Yeah. And even when he seems that he's mostly convinced that Alton is something else, and he's like, okay, he is something else, he doesn't really have like that unshakable, unquestioning transformation until he has that encounter with Alton. And once he leaves behind all his figures and science, not that science is bad, or, you know, psychology and all this stuff, and just encounters Alton, it's undeniable what he's encountered, and he's a transformed person. Not because of how he got to him, but because of his encounter.
Yeah. And isn't he kind of a Nicodemus character? Like, even there at the end, like, he's like Nicodemus went to Jesus at night, you know, when nobody's around. And so Paul has got this thing going on where, like, he's clearly chosen sides at the end, he's chosen sides and shifted allegiances a little bit. But then he kind of smiled when he comes in to interview Roy.
Mm. Yeah. So, I feel like it's so deep and it could go on forever, but I don't want to negate any of the other characters and or Alexis, because the boys have just been talking it up this whole time.
Yeah.
And Alexis, I feel like you should have interrupted us by now. Like, you need to keep us in check.
I'm listening.
Well, okay. So Alexis, are there any journeys or character journeys that you really liked, or character arcs, you know, characters that you really enjoyed in this film?
I liked all of them. I thought they were all, yeah, very believable. You know, even though, like, the mother figure, Kirsten Dunst's character, you don't really spend as much time with her, but I thought even in that short amount of time, I was convinced that she loved this child and, you know, all of that. I think I can relate to Alton, being that I just am very abstract and daydreamy, imaginative type.
And your eyes glow.
Artsy fartsy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my eyes glow. I read comic books. I mean, it's all there. So, mostly just like the whole, I guess, being outside the box all the time and getting in trouble for it, like leaving the car, just doing things you shouldn't do. I can relate to that, but because it's all for something bigger, spiritual, it's for Alton's vision for his life. So I can dig that. But I really liked Lucas a lot, because he
Miss Joel
was
Edgerton's
just this
character.
Extremely, yeah, Joel Edgerton. Yeah. He's extremely loyal friend who, like, just helped his friend out of the blue after not seeing him for however many years, because they were close growing up, you know, as teenagers and younger. And that's something, I mean, loyalty is very important to me, and I treat my relationships with a lot of loyalty. So I that was really cool. And even though he's kind of just a simpler guy, like, that once, you know, Alton showed him the truth, you know, he was like, I'm with you. I'm going to go down with this ship. And, you know, that's that. And I really like that about the character. But yeah, he was still skeptical. He questioned Roy. He questioned the logic of everything they were doing. You know, he was kind of the voice of reason, even though he was ended up being a believer. So I don't know. I thought he was interesting.
Well, I was going to say, And you guys are welcome to correct me if I'm overstepping my bounds here, but I would say that the thing I liked most about Lucas's journey is that it was almost spot on an analogy an allusion to the doubting Thomas. You know, because we have someone who's mm-hmm. on the journey already, and they're as committed as they can be to the cause as best they understand it. And they're willing to, you know, do whatever seems necessary. But once it seems like, you know, practically or realistically, or you described it reasonably, you know, he's the voice mm-hmm. of reason, reasonably that things are over, he's like, hey, we tried, guys. You know, we gave it our best shot. It stinks, but it's over. And you know, that's Thomas. Thomas is like, look, Jesus was cool. We liked what he did. We thought he was going to save us all, but it's over, you know, let's move on. And so then Alton shows back up and shows him his hands. And you know, in the presence of the evidence found in the hands, you know, beating a dead horse, like, you know, Lucas suddenly, also has this transformation or this realization that it went from, yeah, I'm doing this because it seemed like a good idea, or we're all like in this club together, to I actually believe that this is a thing now. And so, you know, much like Thomas putting his hands in Christ's, you know, nail-scarred hands, like there was, like Thomas could not deny it. And Lucas, from then on out, couldn't deny it. He was going to go do whatever. You know, he ends up in jail and doing, you know, running blockades and whatever because, you know, like I said, I'm beating a dead horse, but.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good. Maybe this would bridge the two things we've talked about, Lucas now and somebody who is trying to figure out Nichols or like, tell me why Nichols is so special. What does he do? Lucas is a character who doesn't really say much in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's a silent character. And I would say it takes a pretty special writer and director, which that's what Nichols does. He writes, I think he's written all of his films that he's directed. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah. We can have that fact check in the meantime. You keep going.
Yeah, but so it takes a very special writer and director to have a character that says very little, and yet you feel like you know so well. And I think part of that is because, again, like we mentioned, Nichols likes, and Nichols has said this, he likes to leave room for people to read into his movies. And so even though Lucas isn't saying anything verbally, and a lot of the credit goes to Joel Edgerton here working with Nichols, through facial tics, small gestures, things like that, we have the opportunity to sort of read into and interpret Lucas. Nichols wants us to do that. And so we still feel like we know this character really, really well, even though he doesn't say that much.
Mm. Well,
I felt that way too. I noticed something about last night when I rewatched it, that he doesn't actually explain how he got to be with Alton in this whole situation until they get to his wife's house, and I cannot remember the name of the character. Sarah, there you go. Mm-hmm. They get to her house, and then she asks him, and so he explains his story, which was good to hear because I liked hearing it. But before that, I didn't really question him. I didn't feel like I was missing out. I felt like I knew this character. I felt like, you know, he made himself clear in other ways. So I thought that was kind of cool that when he started telling her that story, it was like, oh, but I thought I already knew that. And I didn't. He actually never said that before. So it's just that, yeah, exactly, to confirm what you're saying.
Mm, the old show, not tell. Masterclass by Jeff Nichols. Confirmed writer and director of all his movies. So
good. Fact there check. You go. Brought to you by Fact Check.
That's right. Factcheck.fizz. So... Maybe with all the things we've kind of danced around, and we've obviously talked a lot. Like we didn't have to think very hard in this movie. We didn't have to stretch our metaphors or our analogies very hard to see how this film, in a lot of ways, points us to the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, just how there are Christian analogies and journeys and faith walks and all these kind of things that you can easily use this as a starting point for. But one of the things that we also have hit around a lot is the fact that this is, or ambiguity is Nichols' game, it appears. He's fine with not having everything answered. He's fine not telling you everything. He's fine raising questions, giving you some pretty compelling things to look at, compare to, and then contemplate. But that does leave us in a place where things aren't answered and that we have a little room to speculate. So in a speculation kind of exercise, I would say that since the film doesn't explain everything, what did the film leave you most curious about, Alexis?
Oh no, curveball.
Well, let me say this, just to give you time to think, since I just threw you on the spot. It's interesting to me that in most of Nichols' films, the movie never seems to be the end. It almost seems to be like the beginning. So
that's true.
So which is weird. So it's almost like we read the preface to a book or, you know, the preamble to a great speech. We got the prologue. Midnight Special is the prologue to a very interesting story that somehow curiously finds Roy and Lucas in prison, even though like everyone in the Southeast just saw this stuff happen and they're being questioned as if they're crazy. Like, hey, why are you locking these guys up? Obviously kidnapping kind of seems like silly compared to what we just witnessed. So I'm just going, well, what happens next? What happens next? How do Roy and Lucas stay in prison when this big thing happens? So that's one of the big questions I'm asking at the end of this. Kind of like at the end of Take Shelter, I'm like, well, what happens now?
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't want to, we are obviously intentionally spoiling Midnight Special, but we're not going to ruin Take Shelter. So something happens at the end of Take Shelter that makes you go, oh my gosh, what happens next? But, so that's kind of what I'm talking about, Alexis.
Okay. Well, and in light of the fact that you missed the flashing eye thing, that will give you even more questions to ponder. I think the question I would like answered is, I want to know why Alton was even part of our world in the first place, if he really didn't belong in this world. It's almost like, and my cousin and I talked about it after we saw it, that we got a very Mary Joseph Jesus vibe, very nativity vibe from this family. Just kind of like I would imagine Mary and Joseph not really knowing what to do with themselves, raising the Christ, kind of just doing what they can and loving this child and everything. There's just a lot of vibes I got from that reminded me of that. And I think I'd like to know, Alton was from that other world. Why was he here? Like, what was it? What was it that he needed to do, or why was he sent here? That's never really brought up or addressed, so that would be interesting to know.
So, Blaine, what was it for you? Or I guess there might not have been anything. You could have been like, I've got all this. I'm completely satisfied 100% with what I've got. but if that's not the case, what were some of the questions that you had at the end?
Yeah, so I can think of two off the top of my head. One is, what happened to the cult? Because they sort of disappear. Now, when I ask that question, I'll clarify that by saying I'm not coming at from the same direction as some people did when they seem to be criticizing the film, as in saying, hey, did you just forget? Like, this seems like bad writing. they just disappear. At least the way I interpret Nichols' film, I see that as a very intentional move. Because, again, if Nichols is sort of making nods to realist filmmaking, he's trying to portray life sort of as it actually is. And again, I'm just saying nods. I'm not saying he's totally realist. This isn't a dogma film or something like that. But if he's doing something like that, Well, we have all had things, and we regularly have things in our life that don't tie up in ways that we understand. Right? Like, we don't always know all the answers to, like, hey, you know, there's a person that I was fighting, and then they all of a sudden just kind of disappeared out of my life. I wonder what happened to them, and we never find out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
We all have these sort of loose ends in our life. So I think that's kind of what Nichols is doing, is it's like, hey, this is what happens in life. I know maybe people could try to dig into the film and say, oh, well, no, this is what happened and this is why. But again, I think Nichols is trying to push us to read into this and wrestle with it. But in this, so when I say my question is why, what happened to the cult, it's almost like I'm putting myself in that narrative. I'm just kind of like, huh, I wonder where they are. I wonder what they're doing. Why didn't they come back around? Mm. Not pointing the finger at Nichols in any way. Does that make sense the way I'm?
No, it does.
Sort of framing. Yeah. So that's number one. I'm just kind of curious about that because I would be curious about something like that in my life. And number two is the eye flashing thing at the end. Because since Nichols is this filmmaker who likes to work in ambiguity, I think the eye flashing thing, whether you see it or not, and even if you do see it, I think it throws a wrench in any sort of like systemization or like thorough interpretation you might have of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So Nichols is doing things like this to sort of keep us continually like turning things over in our mind, wrestling with them, instead of saying, oh, I know exactly what this film is trying to say, and it's trying to say this. I think Nichols is trying to push against that. And for me, that happened most clearly with Roy's eyes apparently flashing at the end, because I've thought about that since I saw it on opening night, and I still have no idea what it does. I have no idea what it does for the movie, what it means in the larger scope of things. So I'm still curious about it, and I am still thinking about it pretty regularly, which I think is a sign you've got a good film on your hands if it will sort of linger with you.
Well, since
so those are the two things.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, since it's something that both of you brought up, I'm kind of interested to hear both of your hypothetical answers since we got a couple more minutes. What could it mean, Blaine?
Oh, I was hoping Alexis was going to go first. Okay. I wasn't just being facetious. Like, I really don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've thought so, like, see the same sort of being as Alton. I still don't know what that does for like the narrative and like what's going on. Like, why couldn't he go to the world on top of ours too? Is he like a half, let's call him angels, a half angel, half person? I genuinely don't know.
Hmm. So it means
I think Nichols would want that.
Well, whatever, we don't care what he wants. We're answering these questions because we're super smart.
So this makes me think of something. I've been working on another project with a comic book artist named Gene Lin Yang. If you've never, I don't know if you've read any of his stuff. He did American Born Chinese, sort of his big, you know, most famous work. Mm-hmm. Great, great writer. Anyways, I was working on a project with him, and I watched a series of lectures he did at Fuller Seminary. And I actually didn't know that Yang was a person of faith until I watched these videos. But in one of the sessions that I watched, Yang put something in a very interesting way. He said, authentic Christianity is not above tension in our understanding of things. Mm-hmm. The authentic Christ and authentic Christianity resides inside of tension. I think that's something Nichols, again, does very well, is he sort of lets us rest in tension instead of pushing answers out at us.
Mm. I mean, I think that's pretty wise. I mean, I think that in and of itself is found in this movie, and it's why a movie like this would be something that I would recommend to a Christian who's like, oh, I want to watch something that kind of has some depth to it, and not, you know, why I would recommend this and not recommend like a actual quote Christian film to them for something mm-hmm. that is theologically weighty.
Wait, are you saying you would actually recommend yes. this movie over Miracles from Heaven? The Jennifer Garner movie?
The Jennifer Garner joint?
Yeah.
So I technically can't say definitively because I have not yet put myself through Miracles from Heaven. but if I had to take an educated guess, I would say yes. I'd say the conversation you'd have after this film is a lot more interesting than the conversation that you would have after Miracles from Heaven. Not to mention the fact that you'd probably be a lot, or you find it a lot easier to get anything but a Christian, identifying Christian, to watch this movie than watching Miracles from Heaven. So Miracles from Heaven obviously has a very specific audience. So that tangent aside, Alexis, I still wanted to give you a chance to pick up the ball and hypothesize about the glowing eyes.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird because it's like, well, if he had those, yeah, why didn't he go to the other world or what the heck? That's kind of like a throw in. But also I was thinking maybe it means that because of Roy's faith and running the race to the end with Alton, so to say, that maybe he'll, it's almost like he's not from there, but he'll be there one day. Mm. So it's more like a hope thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it could have, because of that, it's going to just cause more. I thought it was cool because it was like, ooh, what? You know, it makes you think about it. But I don't know if it's really helpful the way it was done per se. I mean, for most people, I thought it was cool, but I know that a lot of people might find it frustrating because there's no clear reason for that to happen. But I think it's more metaphorical than anything because he was looking at the sunrise when that happened, and that was like a huge thing between him and Alton. So I think it's more metaphorical than it was literal by far.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate both of you giving it the old college try. And I would say that if anyone else has any theories or you noticed that as well, or it was baffling to you, I think whenever we post this in the discussion thread, that I encourage you to put as many theories as you have out there about why that happened. Or just the most interesting thing that you, or the most interesting unexplained thing that happened in this movie to you that kind of got your gears going at the end of the film. But with that, I will say it is time for final thoughts. So Alexis, anything that you did not get to mention so far, any just favorite moments that you want to gush over, anything that made you cringe, just any final thoughts that you have about this film that you want to leave people with?
No cringing.
No cringing.
And that's a good thing.
That in and of itself.
I tend to cringe a lot these days. No, that it's a great film. It's very quiet. And I actually had my husband watch it with me last night, not really sure what he'd think of it. But he did see Take Shelter and thought that was pretty good. And I was surprised. I was like, oh, I don't know what he thinks the whole time. You know, when you're with someone and you're showing them something and you're just like biting your nails over there, like, what do they think? Because to me, it matters because, you know, I'm a quality time person. When I watch something with someone, like, we got to be like full on engaged together or it's no good to me. So he watched it at the end. He was like, no, that was pretty good. He's like, you know, weird. And the ending was kind of strange, but it was really good. And I think, it made him think about stuff too, because he asked questions about it later. So I do think it's a great conversation piece. So like Mikey said, kind of recommend it to people to sort of get their gears turning and talking about a discussion that could lead to a deeper theological discussion.
Mm. Well, I can't argue with that. Anytime someone agrees with me, I agree as well. So Blaine, final thoughts?
Oh,
do we leave anything on the table?
It's just kind of funny that we hardly talked about the cult at all, and we're not really going to because that's a whole nother. It's funny to me. This is how rich Nichols' films are, is that like it's real world theology. We're talking about Christianity, and we haven't even talked about the religious cult movie because there's so much to talk about. I'll leave it with the very profound thought that the religious cult is interesting. I guess to be a little bit more specific, I believe Wade Bearden from Christ in Pop Culture dealt with the cult in a piece that he wrote over at Christ in Pop Culture. So go check that out. Wade's writing is always good.
Always Wade.
Really good.
No pressure.
Yeah, really could talk about that all day.
Yeah. So, and I'll definitely have that in the show notes. So check that out. Well, for me, all I can say is that I did enjoy this film. I feel like the people who saw it before me built it up so high that there was no way I was going to enjoy it to that level. And I realized that I enjoy Jeff Nichols as a filmmaker, but not as one of my favorite filmmakers. I enjoy him on the level that he is one of the most interesting storytellers, even if I don't think the movie is the greatest movie in the world. Mm-hmm. What I mean, I guess, by that, if it's not self-evident, is just reiterating the things we've talked about. I love the fact that it's rare for me to come out of a Jeff Nichols film and feel like he didn't spend a good amount of time blurring reality and something more, whether it's an increased belief in the people around you, or a world that is unseen, or a feeling that you can't explain. I feel like he does have a way to inject a little bit of wonder into an otherwise average, you know, Southern everyday life kind of world. And as whoever it was that I heard say glibly recently, how can the world be wonderful if there's no wonder? So thanks, Jeff, for that. Jeffy baby, appreciate it. Thanks for listening. I know you're probably your favorite podcast. With that, I've really enjoyed talking about this movie. You know, obviously I've been waiting to talk about this movie for many months, and I know you guys have been having conversations here and there, and I'm glad we could all kind of get together and talk about, make sure we're all kind of on the same page, make sure we're seeing a lot of the same things, making sure this movie is more than meets the eye, yet not being a Michael Bay disaster. So with that, to thank you, I think the best way is to allow people to find you to keep this conversation going. So, Alexis, how can people follow you on the internet or follow the work that you do around the web?
Okay, well, the easiest one is Twitter, and my handle is @PhoenicianRises. And I have a website, realcathedral.net, and a corresponding Facebook page for Real Cathedral.
How convenient. All right, Blaine, how can people do all those same things except for you?
You can find me on Twitter @DEPT_of_tourism, famously hard to type in. And you can find my writing and my podcast, Real World Rewind, on Real World Theology. And I also write for Christ in Pop Culture, so you can look me up there.
So make sure you're doing that. As for me, you can follow me @Fizzification on Twitter. And please, guys, go to realworldtheology.com. We have a lot of great writers. We've just added a couple more. We've got a couple more TV series reviews going on. We've got just all kinds of movie reviews. We're finally starting to get to see some movies before they come out, so we can kind of give you a preview of what you might see. Lots of really, really great stuff. Check us out on iTunes or the Google Play Store. Please review the show. I can't express enough how much it helps if you take the time to leave us a review, and not just like the star rating, but leave us some feedback too. The more feedback we get, the more 5-star ratings we get, the better it kind of helps us stand out among other religious entertainment podcasts, or people who are looking for things that we do or that you're obviously interested in since you're listening to the podcast. People can find us a little bit easier. So that we would just really, really appreciate it. So like I said, if you get a couple minutes, do that. We already appreciate the many, many minutes that you've given us for listening to this episode. And as usual, I'm very grateful to Alexis and Blaine for their time. It's always awesome to get together with people that, you know, you can just have a pretty relaxed, chill, and in-depth conversation with, which is what I hope all you guys out there are doing after you see movies like this. You know, don't just go to the theater, get in your car, and go home. Find a friend, find somebody, go to the theater with somebody. I know they say that, you know, watching a movie with somebody is one of the worst things that you can do. It's because you're not having conversations after the movie about it. So have conversations after your films. Talk about how they connected with you, what you liked, what you didn't like, and really explore that. And that's what we're here to encourage you to do. So we hope you're doing that. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening to this episode. Thank you for making us a part of your week. And until next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
I don't know about you guys, or you guys and gals, or guy gal. I feel like there should be some... I feel like I can't say guys anymore. Is it weird, Alexis, if someone says you guys and you're part of the group, does that offend you?
No, it doesn't. And dudes doesn't either, because it's just like, to me, that's general.
It's so. It's colloquial? Colloquial?
Yeah.
Can anyone say that word better than me?
Nope.
Colloquial? No one's
I think you said it right.
Colloquial? Colloquial? Colloquial?
It's quill.
it's quill? Colloquial.